This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Once upon a time, bathing was seen as a risk to one's health. Today, how many of us bathe or shower every day? Maybe use antiseptic soap. We know the importance of washing our hands, brushing our teeth. We take for granted the window screen, refrigerator, and flush toilet. But just 100 years ago, most people had barely an inkling that poor personal and household hygiene could and did cause illness. This afternoon, we take a closer look at how we've come to our knowledge and our ideas about germs and proper hygiene. We'll also look at how concerns about public health changed such things as clothing and home furnishings. Our guest is historian Nancy Tom. She is professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and she's written a book that is a medical and cultural history of germs. The title, The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. The publisher, Harvard University Press. As we talk, your questions are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Nancy Tom, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Was bathing, in fact, a health risk?
No.
No. I was thinking about that, and I thought, well, perhaps the water, if it wasn't clean,
well,
or
perhaps if you drank your bath water afterwards, that would be a risk.
Yeah. How did you become interested in studying our beliefs about health?
I think I've always been interested in the kind of everyday knowledge we have about how to keep safe. Why do we believe certain things? Why do we believe in gravity? Why do we believe in cholesterol? And believing in germs seemed to me to be an especially interesting problem because you can't see them, with the naked eye at least. And to think about the PR job that was required to convince Americans, 100 years ago, that these things existed, it fascinates me as a historical problem.
Mm. The title, The Gospel of Germs, what's the significance of the title?
Oh, it's funny. I worked on the book for years before a really appropriate title came to me. And the word gospel was really reflective to me of the kind of intensity of belief, especially in the first generation to be converted, in a sense. There were other ways of explaining why people got sick prior to the discovery of germs. And here's this small group of people who become converted to this new way of looking at the world. And every aspect of their life had to change as a result. So they would use the word gospel to talk about this new knowledge that they had that they felt was so vital.
And literally, they could be saved.
Indeed. And I think, although it certainly wasn't an easy process, simply learning about this, it didn't necessarily mean that you could prevent your children from dying. When you look at the high infant and child mortality rates in this time period, you can understand why particularly mothers would become so interested in learning about this new theory of disease and the kind of hygiene techniques to prevent these things getting at your babies.
Hmm. You write for that for a long time, people had a sense that they could catch a disease like smallpox from an infected person, but they didn't fully grasp the idea that casual contact with others and contaminated food and water could make them sick. When and how did that begin to change?
Well, the idea that a person could make you sick is an ancient one and reflected in epidemics in the past, that there was a real experience there. You knew if something like plague or smallpox came along that a lot of people would get it, and being around that person was a key factor. The idea that you could catch diseases from objects or from drinking water, eating contaminated food, that idea is also very old, but it would be attributed to other kinds of agents than invisible living microorganisms. So people thought, for example, the weather had a lot to do with epidemics. Not such a dumb idea when you read the paper about how our weather changes now are affecting our disease patterns. But they had other common sense ways of explaining why drinking from a certain creek, you know, you might get sick after that, or why breathing air in an unhealthy city, why that might make you sick. They didn't really connect it with the microorganisms that might be in the water in the air. That came only really in the mid-19th century.
Bad habits were another thing that people attributed as a cause of disease.
Indeed, drinking too much, staying up late at night, just not taking proper care of yourself generally.
Yeah. What diseases were the great killers of the 19th century?
Well, the one that comes to mind is a good example of the change that we're talking about is the disease we know as tuberculosis, and that in the olden days was as likely to be referred to as consumption from the tendency of the disease to just consume the body of the sick person. Prior to the 1880s, the vast majority of scientists, as well as ordinary people, believed that tuberculosis was or consumption was a disease you inherited from your parents. You inherited a tendency to become consumptive, and then if you stayed out too late or you studied too hard, you might bring that on, bring it out, and it's or get wet, get your feet wet, and that would bring on the attack of the disease. And the fact that there was a microorganism involved, very few people suspected.
When did the term germ come into use?
Well, it's an ancient word that, in the sense of a germ of an idea, you see that usage for all kinds of things prior to the mid-19th century. There in classical times was, you can find ancient writers on medicine hypothesizing that there were living creatures that could not be seen that were the agents of epidemic disease. So that idea is actually quite an ancient one, but there wasn't really the kind of proof, scientific proof, that we would accept today. That begins to be developed starting in the 1860s, and with the work particularly of Louis Pasteur. He's the kind of pioneer.
When were germs likened to bugs?
I don't see that. I didn't find that usage really until the turn of the 20th century, the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And I think it coincided with the realization in that same time period that insects actually can carry disease. The idea of the insect vector is the official term. And I think that reinforced the use of the word bug for germ as well as for the fly or the mosquito that might carry a disease organism.
And we call these things disease organisms. So they are, in essence, living creatures that might also come into it as well.
I think, too, when people were trying to, especially I've seen this in patent advertisements and in the kind of commercial, the attempt to use the new knowledge of germs to sell products, that the idea of a bug, or sometimes they look like little worms, you know, anything kind of nasty looking that you could picture to represent this invisible world would be a way of trying to get the consumer to buy your disinfectant or to buy your attachment for the toilet to guard you against these dangerous things.
Yeah. Well, we still do that. We're still doing that today in terms of all the, antibacterial products that are available.
It's one of the aspects of my research that continues to intrigue me the most, and that the sense that what goes around comes around. So much of what I see happening in the late 20th century reminds me of the late 19th and early 20th century. I think a lot of the same general historical changes and phenomena that are going on now, you can find an earlier version of them in the period I was studying. And certainly the role of the market in spreading certain kinds of ideas is a really interesting parallel.
Hmm. You can buy antibacterial soap, of course. It's been around for quite a while. But also now your bath towels and bath mats.
Indeed.
And pillows. And
I think it's the children's toys that really astonish me as well. The protective coatings on the teething rings and the feeding trays. Really remarkable. Quite the imagination that goes into thinking of these products.
Yeah. And yet, health officials are a little concerned about treating
I think they,
all
they,
these
w- with good reason. And one of the negatives about this way of relaying health information is that real information about disease prevention, such as you should wash your hands, that is really one of the most reliable things that one can recommend. But it doesn't matter if you wash your hands with the $10 antibacterial super duper soap or something much more economical that may not be as glitzy in its packaging, and in a genuine desire to keep themselves and their families safe, people can end up spending a lot of money on items that really aren't that useful. And good old fashioned friction and a simple germicidal soap do just as well, if not better, than these high-priced, hyped items.
Mm. Well, back to Mr. Pasteur and the 1860s, 1870s. There were pioneers in the study of bacteriology, and they came over time, in a relatively short period of time, it seems to me, they came to a germ theory of disease. You want to talk with us about that, please?
It's a remarkable story. Sometimes when you go back and you look at the older histories, you find a tone of disbelief. Why did it take so long for people to accept what they were saying? But I have to say, from a historical perspective now, to me, it's more remarkable that it was accepted as quickly as it was. Roughly, you can tell the first sort of the argument kind of coheres around 1870, and by 1900, there's a high degree of scientific unanimity around this idea. Not complete, but really dramatic acceptance. It's being taught in medical schools. It's being practiced in hospitals. 30 years, and especially when I went back to look at the early arguments about the germ theory, what astounded me is really the primitive level of early laboratory proof that was being offered in the 1870s that anybody believed it at all. It still took a leap of faith, and that's back to the idea of the gospel, that you had to be converted to this way of looking at things. And certainly believing in the laboratory and believing in experiments and what they can reveal about the natural world, that was a key part of that shift. Scientists had to start believing in the laboratory, and then would argue by the early 20th century, ordinary people, average people, had to start believing as well that what could be divined out of these test tubes was really a knowledge worth acting on, worth incorporating into your daily life.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it interesting that we have sort of a coming together of science and religion, because you point out in the Gospel of Germs that people, they accepted the idea of a germ, even though they couldn't see it, because they had a faith in a religious, you know, idea in heaven, perhaps. I don't know how to put this exactly, but in a life that they couldn't see.
Mm-hmm. That was something that came to me rather late in thinking about this problem, and it was largely because I'd be reading these scientists or the early public health authorities talking about the old views of disease and how people thought there were these magic spirits and things that would, for example, in the graveyard, that the vapors that would rise up out of the grave and ghosts that would get you. And they talked about how different the new way of looking at disease was, but in my mind, there was a lot of similarity in that kind of explanation, because it was a belief in an unseen world and in forces that couldn't be detected through the normal senses, and making that shift from explaining things in supernatural to natural terms really wasn't as broad a leap as I once thought.
Hmm. Can you give us some idea of what the germ theory of disease was in 1870?
Well, they're really two versions of the germ theory that I found it useful to think of a kind of first version and the second version, and reflecting the idea that our concepts of disease rarely change completely overnight. Instead, what you have is a process where the new information is kind of worked into the old theory. Whether they're scientists or lay people, they're very reluctant to just throw out everything that they used to believe. So what we have in that first period in the 1870s is an attempt to work germs into older ways of explaining diseases, I said before, that we're really aware of the environment, for example, or for the individual constitution. In the first awareness of the germ theory came at a time, especially in large cities in Europe and the United States, where there was a great deal of concern about what they called filth, essentially what to do with primarily human sewage, but also animal remains. You read about these 19th century cities, they're just horrific. Dead animal bodies sitting around, no concern about cesspool emptying or adequate sewage. It was a wonder more people didn't die than actually did. So there was a great deal of concern about the problem of human waste and the kind of byproducts of the body. Primarily in this early period, they're concerned with fecal contamination. So a lot of the first germ theory, in practical terms, I found, revolved around obsessions about people's toilets and the sewer system. The idea that by hooking up to the town sewer system, that essentially you were opening your family up to all the disease from everybody else's household that got deposited there. So the sewer trap, for example, this is something I could never really understand. The idea that you needed some kind of mechanism to keep the sewer air from backing up into your house, and the belief among many, many people that exposure to sewer air, you could be dead in an instant.
Poor Martha Roosevelt.
Oh, I know. I just this last weekend went to visit her son's grave. He's buried in Oyster Bay here in New York, and I thought about poor Martha. She was so obsessed with being clean, and every little speck of dirt had to be taken away, and yet she died of typhoid, which is we don't know how she got it, but most likely it was some form of fecal contamination.
But it probably wasn't in her house.
It might have been, might not have been.
Yeah.
My guess would be just in terms of the what was most likely. Could very well have been a food contamination.
Hmm. Because she had quite a routine of housekeeping.
Yes.
Could you give us some examples of what the daily routine might have been like in Martha Roosevelt's house?
Well, she was obsessed, as were many women of this time, of her class and her time period, with regulating what came in and out of the house. So one of the stories I remember particularly was when the man came to, the working class man came to collect the ashes out of the house, out of the grates, that she would insist upon his barrel being scalded with boiling water before it was brought into the house. Thankfully, I don't think she insisted that he be scalded with boiling water, but I'm sure probably the thought crossed her mind.
Yeah. And she had a strange routine involving sheets.
Yes. She prayed, as did many people in this time period, by literally kneeling on the floor, but in order to avoid contamination, she would lay an absolutely clean sheet down on the bed so that she wouldn't be contaminated by the dirt on the floor.
Mm. How did the campaign for preventing disease begin? Once there was this idea that germs cause disease, who started, you know, leading the charge, and what were the early days of that crusade like?
Well, the leaders tended to be middle, upper middle class, mostly urban born, but not necessarily WASPs. And this, of course, was the beginnings of the progressive period, so reform was in the air, the idea that as American society got larger and more complex, that there were certain kinds of problems that individuals couldn't solve anymore, and that you had to involve reform groups, but you also had to involve the government, the local government, the state government, and eventually the federal government. So there's a whole mindset here that we have certain kinds of problems that can only be solved collectively. And certainly this idea of disease prevention, of preventing tuberculosis, was really the first and the greatest of the progressive era anti-disease campaigns. Was this notion that everyone had to cooperate in order to eradicate this terrible disease. It spread in so many ways that there was no way you could begin to bring down the death rates from tuberculosis without a concerted effort that went from top to bottom in American society.
And what kind of efforts were launched? Today we're familiar with billboards and public service television ads, but in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, how did folks get the word out? How did government and business, everyone, come together in the community and get the word out?
Well, it's interesting that you drew that analogy to today's public service message and the posters and the billboards, because, in fact, the techniques that we still use to this day to develop public awareness about disease and disease prevention actually date from this time period. And again, it was the anti-tuberculosis movement that really began that style of health education and health advocacy, beginning in the early 20th century. Prior to that, there certainly was an attempt on the part of reformers to change the behavior of average people, but they were really limited in the way they went about it. They would print these really dry tracts that likely 90% of the people couldn't understand, and try to distribute those to get people to change their ways. And they occasionally would get a law passed, but then the law would be really impossible to actually implement or administer. So they had the idea, even before the 1900s, of really getting out there and getting in people's faces about these bad behaviors that they had. But what I see as the real change is when these disease, particularly the anti-tuberculosis people, began to start using methods of persuasion that really came out of the marketplace. They were, these early tuberculosis societies saw the kind of, say, advertising campaigns that Quaker Oats and Ivory Soap were developing, and they borrowed a leaf from their book and said, well, this works in terms of making people aware of this product and its virtues. Let's use some of those same ideas to make people aware that tuberculosis is a contagious, a communicable disease, and there are things that you can do to prevent it.
The awareness that tuberculosis was a communicable disease led to some controversy in the Protestant Church.
Yes.
And that also must have been a very, a debate that was a great public education effort as well.
Indeed, and a painful one, as I try to point out in the book. It's one of the interesting features of doing research. I remember the day that I walked into the Presbyterian Historical Society to look at the communion cup controversy, and I'd barely gotten the phrase out of my mouth when the archivist said, oh, yes, we have a folder about that. I thought, oh, my goodness, how many people could be in asking about communion cups? Well, of course they were, because of AIDS. The whole fear of contracting the AIDS virus has led to a similar controversy over the custom of sharing the drinking vessel in communion. The same debate raged in the 1890s, again only among Protestant churches. I didn't know this. I was raised a Protestant, so I knew all about those little cups because we had them in my church. But the fact that in the Catholic Church this was not an issue until the 1960s, mm-hmm. because only the priest tasted the communion wine from the cup. But among the Protestants, this idea of not wanting to share a communion cup with someone you suspected might have some dread disease was a really a painful controversy in many Protestant denominations.
And the old gospel of germs, you know, taught us that, you know, sharing the communion cup or a toothbrush could put us at, you know, at risk of catching disease. And we had to unlearn that in the gospel of germs since AIDS.
Yes. So many of the prejudices and the assumptions that people have about the spread of AIDS are really conditioned, I argue, on this older gospel of germs that was directed at a completely different set of diseases. Diseases that conceivably could be spread, say, by a shared drinking cup. As you say, it's a process of unlearning or being more discriminating in terms of mm-hmm. how you apply your knowledge about germs. They're not all alike. They don't spread the same way. And that we really need to distinguish their different paths.
We're talking this afternoon with historian Nancy Tom. She's professor of history at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. She's written a book that is a medical and cultural history of germs, the Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Your comments and questions are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Peoria. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Don't you think that the natural immunity has been destroyed by a lot of these antibiotics that young kids are getting?
I think that's a serious problem, and the medical community is thankfully becoming more aware of the dangers of overusing antibiotics. So I think you're right, especially for children. Again, it's very hard to tell parents with a sick child, I'm not going to give you anything because what your child has is a virus. So I'm not sure that's going to break the habit. But I have noticed just in the last couple of years much more of a concern among physicians about educating families about the overuse of antibiotics.
What about the yeast infection in women?
Again, you know, that it's not clear that the yeast infection is nearly the kind of danger that, say, an antibiotic resistant some of the E. coli or other kinds of bacteria that really have life-threatening consequences.
Instead of using medicine, why don't they use acidophilus?
Well, there are lots of common sense remedies that really do make more sense to use in everyday life and leave the more serious medicines for when you need them.
The acidophilus actually is unpasteurized milk, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But a lot of these things don't have much of a market value, and again, I think we need to think about why are some of these more expensive cures being promoted. In a sense, there's a market reason behind it.
What about maggots as a healing tool?
That I don't know much about. I have seen probably what you have on television, some of the more dramatic examples of that. But other than that, I don't know much about it.
Well, I'll tell you, I know a fellow that was in a very serious explosion of a high steam pipe in a power company. And, you know, the thing that actually is the worst thing that can happen is that the skin is dead, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, anyway, if you put maggots on, they would eat the dead skin, not the live skin.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. The caller raises, in my mind, the issue of what we call alternative medicine, things that have fallen out of favor, are now seeing a resurgence of interest in them, or we're turning to things such as anything from massage and acupuncture and so on and so forth. Have there been times in the past where we turned away from the science gospel and reached out for things we weren't quite sure of?
Oh, I think that's a constant. I mean, throughout the time period we've been talking about, there was a rich tradition of alternative health medicine practices, some of which were accepting of the germ theory of disease, which is something that surprised me to find out. For example, homeopathy or the water, which is still a tradition in the United States today. Also the use of the water cure and water as a healing substance. The idea that, as the caller brought up, that you need to strengthen the body's natural resistance, is what they called it in the 19th century, immune system, mm-hmm. as we would call it today. That, again, is a very ancient idea. And that each generation comes up with different words and sometimes different practices to sustain that resistance. But the idea is a really fundamental one, that you're constantly trying to balance avoiding the agent of disease, but also keeping up your resistance. So if you do encounter it, your body has a chance of resisting. Now, there are a lot of warlike metaphors that abound in discussions of disease prevention in this period.
Hmm. We're coming close to the end of the time we'll be able to spend together today, and I do want to talk with you about some things that I found absolutely fascinating in the Gospel of Germs that I think the audience would find very interesting. Tell us about the Rainy Days Ladies Club, please.
One of my favorites. In the late 19th, or in the turn of the early 20th century, one of the arguments for shorter skirts revolved around germs. There had been calls for dress reform, particularly among the early women suffrage advocates, that all these heavy dresses were unhealthy and you couldn't move around. And then when the germ theory came along, here was another argument that could be used to argue for lightening the load, literally, that women, especially of the middle and upper classes, were carrying around. The Rainy Day Club originated in New York City and was a group of hygiene-minded women who advocated the wearing of shorter skirts. They got the name Rainy Day because one of the reasons they especially thought this was prudent on days when it rained, because you would not only be picking up a load of bacteria, but also just all that wet on your feet, like your mother would always tell you, predispose you to all kinds of diseases. But they had outfits that they would wear to their meetings to try to proselytize for their cause. It was a revelation to me. I never connected the shorter skirts mm-hmm. that American women began to wear in the early 20th century with disease prevention. But in fact, I found like articles in Scientific American about the dangers of the septic skirt, and the scientist would culture dirt from the hem of a lady's dress and find all these nasty things in it. In effect, the cover of my book is an illustration from the Puck magazine that shows a maid cleaning a lady's cloak, and the lady's children are standing behind her, and off the dust from the cloak are rising the germs of typhoid and tuberculosis.
And the Grim Reaper's in the
background. And the Grim Reaper, yes. And he really looks grim.
The economy was becoming a consumer economy, and women had a good deal of influence in that respect. They were consumers. Would you talk with us a bit about how their choices and how their education influenced hygiene and the role that women played in preventing these horrible diseases?
It's the power of the mother consumer, the wife and mother consumer in this time period was really considerable, because by the late 19th, early 20th century, the majority of household shopping was being done by the woman of the household. So she controlled the power of the purse. Now, remember, women aren't voting yet, in national elections at least, so that their actual political power was limited. But they did have this power in terms of choosing where to spend their dollars. The consumer movement that we have today originated in this same time period with consumers leagues who tried to use that power of the purse for all kinds of reforms, including just working conditions. But one of the areas they became very concerned about was the hygiene of especially food and clothing. One of the things that fascinated me was finding out one of the older versions of the germ theory, what was this idea of fomite transmission, that clothing mm-hmm. can hold disease germs. So there was a move, for example, to reform the garment industry. It's stressed. And you can imagine a mother hearing that kind of story would really be motivated to find out more about where her baby's clothes were coming from.
We have another caller waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Danville. Hi.
Good afternoon. I remember being told some 30 years ago that there was legislation enacted in response to the communicable nature of tuberculosis as to linens in commercial yes. establishments such as hotels and boarding houses.
Yes.
And I thought it related to the sheets and I don't, you know, the bed linens, and I don't, my recollection, as hazy as it is, I thought it was more to the size than to the washing and care of them. Can you?
Yes, I can enlighten you.
I
found out about that as well. The reason that they're focusing on the length of the sheet is that the sheet would be folded back over the blanket. It was the blanket they were worried about, the TB germs. Yes, isn't that fascinating?
I mean, now I remember, because yes. you said something about the length of the sheets.
Yes.
And
in some states it was a 7-foot rule, and another, I think in New York they originally wanted like a 9-foot sheet, and the legislators said, oh, we think 7 is enough.
I think that is just wonderful, because over the years I've thought about that, and I thought I would have no idea of where to look up where, and here you can enlighten me.
Indeed.
2 minutes' time.
And what I ran across in doing my research is that this idea of the long sheet supposedly originated out west, because a lot of people with tuberculosis went out to California and Denver, you know, to try to get better air.
Mm-hmm.
And the hotels out there were so worried. I mean, here they had all these very sick people, and then if you were healthy, you wouldn't want to be in the same, mm-hmm. sleep in the same room that they had been in the night before.
Mm-hmm.
So the long sheet tradition arose in the West, and then states in the East began to adopt it as well.
Well, thank you ever so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Men also were affected in terms of their dress, what they looked like. There was a push to shave.
Yes. That was the sort of male equivalent to the shorter skirt in the mm-hmm. woman, was the campaign to get rid of the germy whiskers. And when you look at the photos of, say, the Civil War generation, you often see them having these mm-hmm. huge curly beards and mustaches and long sideburns. And if you look at young men in the 19-teens and 1920s, you'll notice that if they have any facial hair at all, it's usually a very, very well-trimmed mustache. That, or occasionally some of the older ones still had a little goatee that I think they felt that they could keep clean. But that idea of the sort of complete shift in what was considered an appropriate male custom in terms of facial hair was very much motivated. In the early surgery, when they began to apply the germ theory to surgery, the surgeons found that they really not only had to wash their hands, that's where a lot of the hand washing stuff comes from, but they needed to shave as well, that your hair has a lot of bacteria in it, so that the clean shaven face, you know, starts with the surgeon, but then it becomes a more general custom.
And then when we saw men growing hair long and growing whiskers again in the 60s.
The hippies, yes.
Lots of folks of a certain generation would say, well, I guess it's okay if they keep it clean.
Exactly. I remember that well from my own from my own youth. And I think with many baby boomers, I mean, we just, all of these things were, sounded so ridiculous. I mean, the kinds of things that our mothers and our grandmothers worried about were so foreign, and indeed they were. We were a very fortunate generation because we had penicillin and all the other wonder drugs.
Right, and
you could let your hair grow long and not worry about what was in it.
Exactly. We were a generation, or are a generation, that through our childhood didn't see much in the way of these horrible illnesses. I came after polio.
Yes.
And the sock vaccine. Before us and our children's generation, you know, disease is, you know, a constant.
I wonder often what impact all of this, because it is generational, and what we're going to continue to see the impact of this through our children's lifetimes. I have a 5-year-old, and I look at her and I think about what she's hearing today, and how that's going to shape her whole life. In 20 or 30 years, the disease pattern may have shifted yet again. It may be something else, but she's never going to forget the kinds of what we hear when we're young. Mm-hmm. I think makes the biggest impression on us. And certainly doing this research made me aware of helped me understand fears that especially I think our mothers and grandmothers had. One of the most poignant moments in having written this book for me was after I gave a presentation on it at our medical school. A woman came up to me afterwards and said, you know, for the first time I understand why my mother was so hesitant about physical affection with me. She was an older woman, I'd say in the late 50s, early 60s. She said she was so concerned about spreading disease to her children that the kind of casual kissing and hugging, you know, you usually do with your children, felt very dangerous to her. And I found that so sad and yet really poignant. It was mother love, but it couldn't be expressed as freely.
Well, there's a picture in the Gospel of Germs of a little girl wearing a bib that says, please don't kiss me.
Yeah. I think about that often when I'm kissing the babies in my acquaintance, and how dangerous that would have to seem in an era, say, when tuberculosis was rampant.
What a fascinating subject. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Nancy Tom has been our guest. If you're interested, the title of her book, The Gospel of Germs, Men, Women, and the Microbe in American Life. The publisher, Harvard University Press.